266 DR Waukesha. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is the story.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago, aiming to strike a deal that would avoid a catastrophic default on the national debt. President Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy met late today in the Oval Office. They did not reach an agreement, but McCarthy said their staffs would continue the discussion. CBS News White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy.
The House Speaker came out of the meeting describing it as a productive give and take.
I think the tone tonight was better than any other time we've had discussions.
But Kevin McCarthy says while both he and the president are still aiming for an agreement, philosophical differences remain. Mr. Biden says cutting spending can't be the lone solution to the nation's debt problem. He wants to raise tax revenue. McCarthy continues to rule that out. Stephen Portnoy, CBS News, Washington.
A writer won millions in a recent lawsuit against former President Trump, but she now wants more money. CBS's Matt Piper with details.
E. Jean Carroll's now amended lawsuit seeks at least $10 million in compensatory damages on top of the $5 million she won earlier this month. It comes after what Donald Trump said the day after the verdict during a CNN town hall.
I have no idea who the hell. She's a whack job.
The lawsuit says Trump doubled down that night on his prior defamatory statements.
What kind of a woman meets somebody and brings them up, and within minutes, you're playing hanky-panky in a dressing room, okay?
The original verdict came after a federal jury found that Trump sexually abused Carol in 1996 and then defamed her. Matt Piper, CBS News.
In a Moscow, Idaho courtroom.
Count two, murder in the first degree.
Ryan Koberger, the man accused of killing four University of Idaho college students in an off-campus home, is arraigned. He did not enter pleas to charges of murder and burglary, so the judge has entered a plea of not guilty for him. Prosecutors have 60 days to announce whether they'll seek the death penalty. CBS's Nora O'Donnell on a crane that collapsed in Atlanta today.
A construction crane partially collapsed, injuring at least four people. All are expected to be okay. Neighboring buildings were evacuated. The cause of the accident is under investigation.
TikTok has filed a lawsuit in federal court in Missoula to overturn Montana's first-in-the-nation ban on the video sharing app. That's the same court where content creators filed their lawsuit last week. Loyola Law School professor Lori Levinson.
It looks like TikTok may have a fairly good chance at stopping the ban that Montana wants to place on the use of TikTok in its state. Their argument is such a ban by the state violates the First Amendment.
The Montana Department of Justice says TikTok collects personal information, keystrokes, and the locations of its users. Mexico's Puebla Airport stops flights due to falling volcanic ash from nearby Popocatépetl. This is CBS News.
Need to hire quality candidates fast? You need Indeed. Their powerful hiring platform helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
News brought to you by Gingras Thompson & Walks, your personal injury attorneys dedicated to helping you get the justice you deserve. GTWLawyers.com. They're all in to win.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Matinair. Here's what you need to know. A Burlington teenager is dead after being struck by a train Sunday afternoon. Officials say Jack Myers was riding his bike when he disregarded warning cross signals and tried to cross the tracks anyway, at which point he was hit by the train. Myers was a junior at Burlington High School. The department is working with Canadian National on the investigation. A plan being considered would remove a section of Interstate 794 and replace it with a service street is getting pushback from South Milwaukee, Cudahy, and St. Francis. The communities say the change would significantly increase traffic times and also mean the loss of a Milwaukee Transit System freeway flyer route. Milwaukee's downtown 2040 comprehensive plan includes possible future plans to demolish a part of the freeway along Clybourne Street between Lincoln Memorial Drive and 6th Street. The project would add surface-level street ramps. I'm Jane Matinair. This is Civic Media News.
Accidents can be life-changing, no matter how careful you are. But with Gingras Thompson & Walks, you're not alone. For decades, they've been fighting for the rights of people just like you. They'll let you focus on your recovery while they handle the legal complexities. If you or a loved one has been hurt or killed due to someone else's negligence, contact them now. You may deserve compensation.
All in to win, Gingras Thompson & Walks, GTWLawyers.com.
The four most dreaded words.
My computer is down.
Oh boy, that bites. Remain sane. PC it back together. We'll fix the pain. Rated number one PC doctor in Southeast Wisconsin. Great service, great rates, and fast service with no trip charge. Experts with PCs, laptops, network servers, protection, backups, and can even help you remotely. Click PCitBack.com or call us at 262-706-3235. That's 262-706-3235. Remain sane. We fix the pain.
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
You are never far away from your favorite local radio station. We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app, and we invite you to get social with us by following our network's Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook pages. Want even more? CivicMedia.us.
Those jobs. When you go, well, go out there and find jobs that aren't in your neighborhood. Because look, I understand what it's like to not live on the bus line. I understand what it's like to live in a place where there aren't going to be jobs that you're going to be able to get. And it's actually going to cost you a fortune to go way on the other side of humanity to get another one. I get that. So for me, if there's going to be a work requirement, and this is something Republicans are never going to go for, There's got to be a job there. So that makes for me, as I've been saying for the longest time, government, the employer of last resort. Because I know the private sector doesn't want to create enough jobs. They're not going to. They want to create as minimal number of jobs as they can because they want profit. Seems simple. Now, the president and the speaker met today. Yes, yeah, it's what you expect. Yeah, we're having conversations. We hope there's going to be an agreement. It just is what it is. It's the message, and the reality is, this is just another bad rerun of terrible GOP policies. We've seen this. Oh, we've seen this movie before. We've seen it. Just different characters. Less compelling characters this time, I would argue. But we've seen this movie before. This is just a bad remake. This isn't even a ready-for-TV version. Now, here's the thing. Most Americans, they want to see cuts. We want cuts because we've been trained like Pavlovian dogs to think about government operating like our kitchen table. And the first thing that we generally do when we're at home and we go, hey, you know, we got to cut back on some stuff, you know, tighten the belt a little bit, maybe cancel HBO or, you know, something. That's not how this works, but they've got us trained like this. So for me, I go into this world of, yeah, I'm not opposed to cuts. It's what are we cutting and why? Again, when we cut things in our house, it's not basic necessities. It's not, are we going to pay the electric bill? Are we going to pay the mortgage? Are we going to fix the hole in the roof or in our case in the basement? Are we going to do this? The answer is no, of course not. Now, the president has laid out a plan of doing some spending cuts. And I'm on board with this. For instance, you know, they want to cut about $200 billion a year that we hand over to Big Pharma. Seems pretty reasonable considering Big Pharma is one of the most profitable industries in this country. Why are we giving them more? The gas industry, which is robbing us blind. Why are we giving them $31 billion in tax breaks? Real estate loopholes that are out there. Why are we giving the real estate industry more money? There's about $19 billion. Evidently, there's a cryptocurrency trading loophole that I did not know about that could save us $24 billion. We just have to trade and change that. Now, for me, I go, well, that seems pretty reasonable. That's about, you know, $275 billion worth of cuts. That seems like a good start, right? Might get you somewhere down the line. And it doesn't seem like any working person was going to get hammered by it. And what I've said before and what I said last week is, look, Republicans, and this is a red hat, blue hat thing. And it shouldn't be. You know, red hat, blue hat, red hats, you know, they want to cut things for poor people. Blue hats want to cut things out, you know, that rich people get. And I'm more on the side of that. Hard hat people got to go, hey, okay, we're going to cut stuff. How's it going to affect our economy? How's it going to affect our communities? How's it going to affect our kids in school? How's it going to affect our heroes? Remember, we love putting people up on pedestals only to, well, in moments of inconvenience to kick them to the curb. This is one of those moments. Now, understand, there are red hats, blue hats here. Red hats want massive cuts to social programs, want massive cuts to, well, government across the board. A slash across the board. And you go, well, what does that mean? Well, what that means, that means things don't get done. For instance, I saw the Department of Transportation. They put out a thing that said that if we do what the Republicans want to do, we do the massive cuts across the board, the sequester 2.0, if we do what Republicans want, there will be, their words, about 375 air traffic control towers that will be shut down. And you go, well, should we be doing that? I mean, wouldn't that hamper air travel, which is already, you know, poorly, already struggling? Do we really want more things shut? And the answer is no. Not for working people. That's bad. The billionaires, they're going to be fine. They've got their private jets and their private systems. They're going to be fine. You and me, we're the ones who are going to suffer. The VA, for instance. We've talked to a number of people here recently have said, look, if you do this funding cuts, if you slash this stuff, our heroes, our veterans, they're going to not get the appointments they need. We're going to slash the number of workers at the VA, which were already like 60,000 fewer than we need, which means appointments are going to take longer, which means people are going to die. But hey, ideologically, it's cutting government. Government's bad. Government spending's no good. And this is just one of those moments where you keep going, okay, red hat, blue hat. They want to claw back all the COVID funds. Okay, I'm not totally opposed to it until we find out what that COVID money was supposed to do. And that's to help people stay in their homes for the short period, to get them through this next couple years. You know, because I'm sorry, you don't just shut down the economy and flip on a switch. And everything's back to normal. There's infrastructure that needs to be provided. We talked about last week about public health systems across this country and states and cities going, hey, wait a second, you claw this money back, we might lose a hand on the sexually transmitted diseases that are now on the rise. Highest number since the 50s. But hey, we need to punish those poor people. And, you know, it's just, it's one of those things where you question, explain to me. I need to know, just from a working class perspective, how is it we're okay giving massive tax breaks to the very wealthy? Loopholes and all kinds of stuff, all kinds of privileges and all kinds of wealth we're handing there. And we're literally going to take food out of the mouths of children. Now, understand my perspective where I grew up as a kid going to, you know, one of those places over the summer where they gave out free lunches. That was part of Johnson's Great Society in our housing project, the Puritas Elementary Schools, where people lined up around 11 o'clock noonish. And it wasn't much, a little thing of beans and wieners, maybe a mac and cheese, something. But for a lot of those kids, the only hot meal they got all day. Reagan came in, gone. Because that era, late 70s, early 80s, that was the neoliberal push towards making people more responsible for themselves. Pull yourself up by the bootstraps. And then hand everything over to corporate America. And this is the thing that drives me insane, because we're told, now remember, we're told, and we've been trained like Pavlovian dogs to think about taxes. Blah, we just foam at the mouth. And again, I always ask that next question. Okay, if we're cutting taxes, on whom? If we're raising taxes, on whom? And what are we going to use it for? If we're cutting taxes, what programs get slashed? What spending gets slashed? Is it that school lunch program that kids in my neighborhood benefited from? Is it the summer programs that kept kids off the streets and into some kind of activity so they weren't left to their own devices? Is that possibly? And then I'm against that kind of slash and burn. Is it taking money from veterans or seniors or homeless? Those are all really bad ideas, because twofold. One, morally, it's just ridiculous. But two, financially, fiscally, as someone who's fiscally responsible, this is one of those moments where you spend a couple of bucks now to keep people, you know, somewhat on the straight and narrow, help keep them off the streets. It's going to cost you less over the long haul, especially if you can get people the help that they need so that they can become productive adults and move forward. I'm all about that. Look, where I grew up, and I know lots of people, I know lots of working people who tell the exact same story. When we did our Working Class Heroes tour, I met hundreds of people who said the exact same thing. We grew up poor. And because of this government program or this help, because of public education, because of you name it, I got the skills, the opportunity, the chance to lead a better life. And now and I say this about myself, but I heard this on the road, I'm leading a life I never thought possible. And I'm paying tax. Taxes, lots of taxes. of electrical things going on lately. And I'm not sure why, but, you know, we've been in this spot where we just lost the feed entirely. And I'm not sure at this point. I'm in a spot where I'm going, trouble, folks. Okay, so evidently just a hiccup. And it's one of those weird things where you look at what happens. For some reason, internet access problem. And this is where, again, the hope, the Biden folks are going to help us get better internet. Just my thoughts. But here's the thing. I've been saying for years, who's going to be this generation's Harry Truman? Who's going to be the person who steps forward and holds people accountable? Now, what's interesting to me is that there was a story over the weekend. 60 Minutes had a piece that grabbed my attention. And it's one of those things where you go, we've known this for years. It's nothing new here. But they talked about the Pentagon. And they had this piece, and I love the opening of the piece, where there was a picture of the Pentagon with a giant screw through the middle of it, with a tag, like a price tag on it that said price gouging. And CBS News reported it as how the Pentagon falls victim to price gouging. It's not victim. This is not a victim situation. This is corporate America gouging consumers. This is corporate America gouging us and politicians who have helped them. This is the moneyed interest. This is the political elite. These are the folks at the very top going, hey, we control things. We control everything. And this story, it's over on 60 Minutes, and I highly suggest watching it. It's just about 13, 14 minutes. They talk about the fact that, our defense budget is about $848 billion. It's the largest Pentagon budget we've ever had. And half of that goes to defense contractors. Half of that goes to corporate America. And what the one guy said, and I'm not surprised by it. When the government negotiates the contracts with these defense contractors, they always negotiate it in a profit margin. Usually about 12 to 15%. That's what's negotiated, which is a healthy margin. And what the guy said is actually the profits that they're making is about 40%. And you go, what? And I started thinking about, this person who said that, we give tax cuts to these corporations so that they increase productivity and they research and they do all this stuff. And they had this cute little graph on their story that I liked. It was just there for a second. I had to actually stop the recording. And it said that from 2000 to 2009, R&D dropped from 6.2 down to 5.9. So the amount of money that they're spending, going down. Stock buybacks and increased dividends went from 3.7%. Again, this is 2010 through till now, went from 3.7% to 6.4%. So again, things are screwy here. And you go, well, why is that? Well, as they pointed out, defense contractors went from about 51 back in the 80s down to 5 now. They've monopolized, and we've cut government jobs, we've cut oversight, there's no cops on the beat, and you wonder why we're getting screwed. Those Stinger missiles, those shoulder Stinger missiles they talk about, went from about $25,000 a piece in 1991 to now over $400,000. It's crazy what we let them get away with. Let's go to the phones. Got Steve on line one. How are we doing, Steve?
Yeah, Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, what's on your mind?
Great, yeah, I wanted to make a couple of points. And I too, saw the 60 Minutes piece. There were a number of components that they left out, and I really wish they would have touched on them. Because, as you pointed out, the Pentagon is not a victim here.
Nope.
What is going on here is it's a cooperative effort. You know, if you actually do the research, you find out that the people who are in charge, colonels and generals, high-ranking officials at the Pentagon, who are in charge of greenlighting these projects and overseeing these projects, well, you know, miraculously, after they retire, they're 20, 25, 30 years in, they somehow end up with a $500 million job within a defense contractor within a couple of years, as if that's somehow a mystery. So, yeah, you green-lighted a billion-dollar defense program, and, yeah, you ended up with a job a couple of years down the road, if not sooner, working for a subsidiary, working directly for one of these major contractors. I mean, what do you think is going on here? I mean, and it's not anything that has to be said. You know, it's just the sort of thing, you know, you're out to lunch, you're having a meeting. Hey, you know, you're the kind of guy that, you know, we could really use. How much longer are you going to be in the military? And you know, the message is clear that there's something waiting for you. But, of course, you know, unless you're a complete idiot, you know it's contingent upon you green lighting what they want.
Yep.
And they're giving you peanuts because several hundred thousand dollars as a consultant down the road compared to a multi-billion dollar contract is nothing. I mean, where else in America can you bid on X? If I'm going to build you a apartment complex and I'm bidding this amount of money, and then I come back to you and say, oh, it's going to be double that, by the way. Oh, wait a minute, what the heck? Why did we have a bidding process then? I mean, this is the license to steal.
Yep,
the last,
absolutely.
Possibly one of the last places, it's a license to steal. And nobody cares, and part of the reason is, quite frankly, that nobody wanted to look into this because for over 20 years we were involved in a war somewhere, and to question this process was to be perceived as being lacking patriotism.
I know, I hear
not,
you. Spot
not
on.
Supporting the military.
I'm with you, Steve. Good stuff. Appreciate it. Got to take a break here.
Thanks.
Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day known as the Battle of Deputies Run. The Minneapolis Teamster strike was in full swing. For 3 days, the city was peacefully paralyzed. The wealthiest had kept the city an open shop for decades through their citizen alliance and now assembled an army of strikebreakers. Strikers had been seriously injured on Saturday the 19th at the city market. They fought police and deputized specials in an attempt to keep produce trucks from moving out. Later that evening, flying pickets were ambushed in Tribune Alley after having been dispatched by an agent provocateur. Strikers were beaten mercilessly, including several of the women's auxiliary. The sight of bloodied women enraged the strikers. Another fierce confrontation was inevitable. Hundreds of strikers waited at the Central Labor Union near the market until Monday, when scab trucks were expected. Fighting continued throughout the morning. No trucks moved. Hundreds of women marched to the mayor's office demanding, "Take your hired thugs away." Anti-union violence so outraged building tradesmen that 35,000 walked off the job in sympathy. Electricians, painters, and iron workers all reported to strike headquarters. Then, on this day, that Tuesday, the decisive battle began. Tens of thousands amassed in the market on the side of the Teamsters as deputies would attempt to move the produce trucks out. Strike leader Farrell Dobbs noted it became a free-for-all. The police stayed back as strikers and deputies battled it out until finally the deputies dropped their clubs, turned tail, and fled. Union forces cleared the market of every last scab, cop, and deputy. Historian Brian Palmer notes an intense and deadly confrontation was over in short order, and it left the union in command. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
It's an odd marketing strategy for an industry to assail its own customers. Yet, that's what the monopolistic meatpacking industry, led by such huge conglomerates as Tyson, Smithfield, JBS, and Hormel, that control nearly 70% of America's pork market, is doing. Just shut up and eat your bacon, the industry shrieks. The target of their corporate tantrum is the growing grassroots movement of consumers, animal rights advocates, farmers, and others who are dismayed and disgusted by Big Pork's profiteering on animal cruelty. None of your business, shout the executives, lobbyists, lawyers, and far-rent politicians who run the torturous system. but gutsy groups like the Humane Society made their way inside the industry's animal factories, videoing such mass horrors as thousands of pregnant sows locked for 16 weeks at a time in gestation crates so small the animals can't even turn around. In 2018, such exposés prompted 60% of California voters to approve a ballot initiative outlawing the use of these inhumane crates. Adding plutocratic stupidity to their greed, the pork barons then sued the people for overreaching their power. Yes, the pork profiteers actually asserted that democracy, i.e. people power, must not interfere with, quote, sound business practices. Never mind that few of us uncorporatized commoners consider animal suffering to be a sound practice. Even the corporate coddling Supreme Court gagged at the industry's claim that it has the sovereign power to dictate what type of pork chops are available to the public. This month, in an Oddfellow 5-4 decision rendered by two progressive judges and three corporatists, the court ruled that policy choices like these usually belong to the people. Well, yes, and to the animals. This is Jim Hightower saying, here's an example of how grassroots activism matters in important ways. To stay involved, go to humanesociety.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Fun story. You know, I love the Clarence Thomas stuff. What we've learned, or at least what I've learned from all of the Clarence Thomas information, all the stuff that's coming out, all of the epiphanies, all of the news, I've learned that I have all the wrong friends. I need better friends. I haven't taken half a million dollar vacation. Nobody's bought my grandparents' house. Nobody pays my kids' tuition. I got the wrong friends. Now, Harlan Crow, the guy who's done all this stuff, he said that he would never, has never, nor would ever think of talking about matters related to the judiciary with Justice Clarence Thomas. He said they talk about things that friends talk about, you know, work. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the work talk, I've asked my good friend Pete Dominic to come talk with us. Pete's a stand-up comic, also host of the fabulous podcast, Stand Up with Pete Dominic. You can find that at standupwithpetedominic.com. Pete, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, I'm very excited to be joining you. I'm here to let you know that I would like to fly you and your spouse or whoever you want to Nova Scotia. There is no return flight, and I don't have any place for you to stay. You'll be staying outside.
All right.
But then I'm going to pay tuition for somebody. Not like a very expensive school, probably some like, you know, church school, some after school program, something very low end. But I feel bad. I mean, somebody needs to take care of you the way Harlan Crow is taking care of Clarence Thomas and so many others as well. I sense your sadness and jealousy there. So I'm here for you.
A little bit. Yeah, but here's the thing. I'm not seated on the Supreme Court. So I don't generally attract those kind of friends. It seems kind of odd because I've asked a lot of people and I know some fairly wealthy people. I've asked them if they engage in this kind of stuff because I'm, again, trying to find a cheap vacation. They don't do it either. This seems, other than people in really powerful positions, this seems rare. This seems like rarefied air, Pete.
Oh, I think influence peddling is pretty common, all the way from local politics and local government, all the way up to the Supreme Court and the federal government. If you've got money, you want to keep that money, you want to make more money, and so you peddle influence. I mean, we've been seeing that all over human history, and it's always a surprise when you see somebody who has a lot of money who doesn't use it to influence people to keep and make more money. I'm surprised when they don't.
No, I'm with you. It's because it's fairly cheap. I mean, to be honest, you know, you think about the amount of money that's spent on politics, fairly cheap considering the return on investment.
You know, the thing that I never really understand sometimes is like how we don't agree on kind of a sense of just a general sense of fairness. If I've been waiting in this line to get into the store or the restaurant or whatever it is, the amusement park, and then you can't come up and stand ahead of me. You can't. Budge me, as we would say in high school. There's a certain sense of fairness. And I think the idea that we don't want money in politics is a pretty decent idea. I would think that most people would agree to try to limit the donations and disclose them if need be. But unfortunately, it's not about fairness. It's about winning, at least on the right. I mean, on the left, it's for a long time. And we've been trying to, just like pretty much every other country in the world, publicly finance campaigns and create as much transparency as possible, overwhelmingly. But this right-wing Supreme Court, starting with the, you know, John Roberts and Citizens United, has made it harder and harder and harder to find out who's giving money, how much money, where it's coming from. And I'll never really understand that, because just I want to be able to say that fairness isn't a liberal or conservative idea. It's not a political idea. It's just a, you know, a human idea, fairness.
No, it seems like it should be. And it seems like, you know, when you talk to people, you know, face to face, they get it. But, you know, individually, they get it. But in mass, a lot of people, no, you know, money is speech. You know, corporations are people. And no, they're not. No, yeah. It's not. Or it shouldn't be. And I agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, it's not in any other, in almost any other country, civilized country. I mean, they have publicly financed political campaigns and parliamentary systems, and many of them, of course, they don't have our type of gerrymandering. You know, there's all kinds of different ways to rig the system, and we've rigged it just about as much as we possibly can. But when it comes back to campaign finance, much less, you know, buying a judge, I thought that at least was out of bounds. I'm shocked. Honestly, I am shocked, knowing everything we know about Clarence Thomas, that he has allowed himself to be so bought by this guy. It's hard to understand how he can maintain his position on the Supreme Court, but there's no sign that his job is in any way in danger.
No, there's not. But here's the thing. I mean, you know, I was talking about this, you know, not too long ago, you know, when Scalia passed, you know, where was Scalia?
Yep, he was on a hunting trip with a billionaire.
Yeah, I mean, on that billionaire's resort. I mean, yeah. This is not new. It's been happening for years. We've just turned away from it, and no one's ever held accountable. It's one of the open secrets. It's like the thing over the weekend. I'm sure you saw the 60 Minutes piece on the Pentagon. How long we've been talking about $400 toilet seats? Yeah. And I got emails from people surprised. Oh, my God, can you believe this? Yes, I can believe it. We're getting gouged at every turn, whether it's missiles or it's eggs. We're getting gouged by corporate America and these people every single day.
Yeah, it's not surprising that what's gone on in the Department of Defense, obviously, with spending. And I'm glad that they were able to do that audit and somehow catch them, that they were getting screwed. But I mean, going back to Clarence Thomas or Scalia, it's one thing to take a vacation. You know, it's one thing to take a trip. It's almost fungible. You can say, hey, listen, I paid my own way. This is a friend of mine. He happens to be wealthy, whatever. Maybe he put me up. I shouldn't have done that. It looks bad. But did, you know, Clarence Thomas let this guy buy his mom's house, put a kid through school.
Cool.
I mean, the list goes on and on with what Harlan Crow has done for Clarence Thomas and his family. It's unprecedented, Rick. We've never seen anything like this. And I think it's worth just mentioning that in terms of a judge. I mean, when I worked at the Colbert Report, I remember in different jobs I've had where politicians came through, like John Kerry came in or Bernie Sanders came in, like they wouldn't even take like a pretzel. They wouldn't take anything that seemed a ride to the show, like in any way a monetary transaction of anything. They just wouldn't do it. And to do that, you're not supposed to appear in any way like you're being compromised, like you're being paid off. That's most that work in government, and it's the exception, I think, though, the guys that take money like this, because it's just a great way to destroy your reputation. I just can't believe it's a Supreme Court justice, or I guess I can't
believe it. I've been saying for years they should wear the robes like NASCAR jackets.
Yeah,
you know, look, this court, more than any you know, probably in the last 100 years, is on the side of corporate America, which is why, again, I come back to this debt ceiling fight. I think Biden should invoke the 14th Amendment, throw it over to the Supreme Court, and let the corporations take care of it, because evidently our political system won't.
Well, he's probably going to have to do something. Well, that's the only real thing that he could do, because otherwise the destruction will be permanent for all of us forever. I mean, like interest payments for everybody will go up forever. He's going to have to do something like that, but there's no good answer. I mean, this Supreme Court could very well overturn it and make him look even worse and then blame him, and Democrats could get blamed in the election. There's no real good answers here. I mean, the problem going back to the debt ceiling here was that they couldn't never gotten rid of it. People keep saying Democrats should have gotten rid of it when they had the votes. They never had the votes. You had two senators that would never allow for it. But still, I still have to go back to the Supreme Court being bought and paid for. Rick, like, they don't run for office every 2 years or every 6 years. Like, it's harder to pay them off. I think ideologically, they're obviously, you know, five or six justices that are very pro-corporate everything. But that could be their ideological point of view as opposed to being influenced by money. I'm still shocked that Clarence Thomas has allowed himself to be put in this position. And even before that, Jenny Thomas being an insurrectionist, I mean, and everything that she's been involved in, all the money that she's taken and not disclosed. This guy's had more chances to disclose all of that. He didn't. He should be gone. He never should have been there to begin with. Thank you, Joe Biden, on that. But, you know, he's not going anywhere. I think it's important to, I mean, John Roberts won't even go up and answer questions at the Senate. He's like, I'm good. Thank you.
No, he knows there's nothing good, because I got to wonder how much of the other ones are doing things that they shouldn't be doing. Again, you come back to how a good number of them got onto the court, the power of this Federalist Society. This is not just something new that popped up out of last week. This is something from the early 70s that they have built, that they have harnessed, that they have honed into a machine to create the people that they put on the court. This isn't just by happenstance. These people were created to be on this court. They were funded all along the way, probably from the days when they were in college all the way through now, groomed to take these seats. So for me, I am not surprised in any way, shape, or form of what Thomas has done. He just got caught.
Kavanaugh and Gorsuch went to the same high school, Rick.
Of course they did. And they were part of the same Federalist Society that ushered them through.
Yeah, the Federalist Society, by the way, just got like $1 billion, right? I mean, they're not going anywhere ever.
Ever.
Not in our lifetime. I mean, they're just going to keep spending that money and trying to influence, you know. But that's why you got to keep Democrats in charge so that they can't appoint those crazy judges. But still, I mean, the idea that there's no code of ethics for the Supreme Court the way there is for every other court in the land. Like, all Americans should agree that there should be a code of ethics, and they should not have lifetime tenure. That is preposterous. Yeah. The hearing should be televised. Don't get me started on the reforms that should happen at the Supreme Court that aren't going to happen, but we should be all in support of it. Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative, because everybody has something to gain or lose if the wrong people are in charge.
So last week we had Ed Markey on the show talking about his bill to expand the court. I personally don't think it's got a snowball's chance, but it's an interesting idea. Throw an additional 4 justices on the court up to 13, swing the balance to somewhere back to sane. This maybe for a little while gets solved. Thoughts?
Yeah, it's dead on arrival. I appreciate Senator Markey. I like him a lot. I'm glad that he's proposed that idea. I love what Sheldon Whitehouse has tried to do to expose the capture of the Supreme Court and Congress and the corruption. I think those guys are doing really important work trying to create, you know, a groundswell of support for some of these reforms. But the vast majority of Americans aren't going to support it. And you're not going to get President Biden, obviously, to support it. I mean, people have been saying pack the court for a long time, but there's never been any hint of any movement on that, much less, you know, reinstating the Voting Rights Act or restoring the Voting Rights Act. I mean, we can't even get that done. I mean, a lot of that, by the way, it doesn't have to do with Democrats not having the political courage. I don't love that. Or even Joe Biden not having the political courage. It goes back to the United States Senate filibuster rules. Yep. And as long as you got Joe Manchin and Kirsten Sinema there, you couldn't pack that court. You couldn't do it. You couldn't add anything. You can't get some of the most important legislation like the Voting Rights Act being restored, or criminal justice reform, or so many other things to be done without some kind of really extreme measures. We cannot get it through that damn U.S. Senate.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show here with Pete Dominic, Pete, the stand-up comic, also host of the fabulous podcast, Stand Up with Pete Dominic. We'll get links out on social media, how you can take a look at that. Want to get your thoughts on some of the entrance into the 2024 presidential foray. Today, Tim Scott, he has announced that he's in. What I do find interesting, that he's a guy who wants to ban abortion totally. And according to a Post Courier article, South Carolina's 46 counties, 14 of them have no OBGYN doctors at all. Another five only have one. So in 19 counties out of the 46 in South Carolina, there are five OBGYNs in that entire area. And we're going to force more people, going to force more births. Brilliant.
Yeah, he's running for vice president. I think it's pretty clear. Name recognition. He doesn't have much of that. The vast majority of Americans don't know who he is. The idea that a black Republican could win a presidential primary, much less the nomination, is a joke. Obviously, let's be honest.
$30 million from Larry Ellison into his Opportunity Matters fund. That's going to get him a lot of name recognition.
Is that right? Larry Ellison gave Tim Scott $30 million.
That's what's been reported. Wow. It's been in motion since 2022 midterms when Ellison donated $30 million to a pro-Scott Super PAC Opportunity Matters funds.
I mean, we saw Tim Scott have his best day of the campaign today, and it was a horrible day. I mean, like we've been having a fairly highbrow conversation up until now, and I'm going to, you know, devolve it into the basics of politics, which – as a stand-up comedian, as a performer, as a radio guy, I get this intimately. There's a certain way that you have to carry yourself, perform, speak, and behave, or people won't trust you, they won't believe you, they'll be uncomfortable to support you for office. And you've got Ron DeSantis and Tim Scott, who are two guys who have no idea how to behave. They have weird behavior. They say things strangely. They act strangely. Today, Tim Scott his 40 minutes or so talking were a disaster. You know, at one point, he's like, I can't hear you. Like Hulkamania, you know, running to each side of the ring and holding his hand at his ear. I can't hear you. He was trying to get people fired up, and he wasn't doing a good job. I think, honestly, like it was cringeworthy watching him today. I was cringing because he's not good at it. He's not good at being on stage. I mean, Donald Trump's an exception. He's an exception. There's nobody like him. There'll never be anybody like him. It's still hard to believe that he's, you know, in any way popular just because of the way that he looks, the way that he acts, the way that he talks. Someone might say, if, you know, he can do it, maybe Tim Scott or Ron DeSantis. No, nope. Donald Trump is one of a kind. He was hugely famous for terrible things before he ran for president. Tim Scott and Ron DeSantis are so awkward, so unlikable, so unrelatable. They're going nowhere just because they don't know how to appear in public, talk, behave, and make people like them. They can't do it. I'm surprised they've gotten this far.
Well, look, they got billionaires behind them. I mean, this is the weird kind of thing. One guy's got a whole bunch of money, said, I'm going to push this guy through. I mean, Rick Santorum had a guy who kept pushing him into the presidential election cycles. He never had a chance of winning, but he had a guy with a lot of money.
He never had a chance of winning, but at least he wasn't like super awkward. Like, really? I worked with Rick Santorum a lot. I worked with him a lot at CNN. Like, he was not a real awkward guy, like a normal guy with crazy beliefs. But like, the way that he carried himself, the way that he communicated was like the normal, pretty normal for a congressman and then a senator. That's how he was. He was passionate. He's angry. He's obstinate. Always wrong. Whatever. But like Ron DeSantis and Tim Scott. Listen, put billions of dollars behind them. You know, they put billions of dollars behind movies, and sometimes nobody goes to see them, Rick, whatever your name is. I keep saying Ron DeSantis. I want to call him Rick DeSantis. It has nothing to do with you. I just don't want to call him by his own name for some reason. And I don't think anybody does, because the guy is so bizarre, Rick. He's a weirdo, and it doesn't matter how much money you put him behind him, because when he walks into a diner like he did in New Hampshire this week or whenever he was up there, he's just ridiculous. He doesn't know where to be. He doesn't know how to stand. He doesn't know how to stand, Rick. He doesn't know how to stand there.
There is that. So let me ask you, of the people who are in so far, and the list keeps getting longer and longer. I guess Glenn Youngkin's back considering the possibility. Chris Christie might throw his name. And there's a whole bunch. Your guy, the last time you were on, he's not in. No Mike Pompeo. What happened there?
I still hold to my word that Mike Pompeo will be the nominee. I know he said he was dropping out and he wasn't running, but I'm never wrong about these things. You'll see. He's going to come back. When Trump goes to jail, Pompeo's going to announce. Some of these guys are counting on Trump going to jail. Yep. Not that that would stop Trump from running. I mean, he'll still run if you were in jail.
Sure,
you could
do it. It's been done before.
Yeah, but nobody has any chance. Nobody. As long as Donald Trump is alive, and maybe even if he's dead, they'd still vote for him. But he is going to be eating them all up at a buffet. Yum, yummy. He's not going to attack the ones that he thinks don't pose any threat to him at all, and he's going to destroy those who do. And then there's a third category of people he has a personal vendetta against because they said, you know, something critical of him. So that's Chris Christie's in that category. Christie's going to talk tough and say all kinds of things about Donald Trump. He's never going to be with him on the same, you know, stage. Trump won't let himself be on the same stage probably with any of these people. So it's just going to be, you know, ads and comments and tweets and whatever, and a war of attrition. And Donald Trump is going to be getting 50%, and they're all going to be getting the single digits. And that it's already decided. It's cooked. It's baked in. There's not going to be any surprises.
All right. I look forward to those predictions.
Except for Mike Pompeo.
Except for Mike Pompeo, of course.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Pete, as always, I appreciate the time. Keep up the great work, buddy.
Thank you, buddy. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate you, as always.
Anytime, Pete Dominic. Remember, check out his podcast, standupwithpetedominic.com, the website. We'll get links out on social media. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show for working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1969. That was the day that began the first strike of the Chicago Teachers Union. The strike lasted 3 days, but it won teachers a $100 per month pay raise. The school board also agreed to hire 750 more teachers to help ease the overcrowded classrooms that plagued many Chicago public schools. Some of the most important victories of the strike came for black teachers. Prior to the strike, many black educators in the city could not find full-time positions. Instead, they were relegated to a permanent substitute status. In order to teach full-time, the teachers had to pass an exam. The exam included an oral portion. Often the testers would fail black teachers who had moved to Chicago from the South. They called these teachers' Southern accents unprofessional. The oral exam became a way to bar black teachers from advancing to full-time status. In the years before the strike, black educators were organizing around this issue. They also demanded changes to the school's curriculum to better include black history and literature. These black teachers did not gain much support, even from their own union. They began to organize sick outs to demonstrate their commitment to these changes. One result of the strike was an end to the discriminatory exam process. After the strike, the school board agreed to include more African-American content in the curriculum. The teacher strike had shown the power of the union. Over the next 20 years, CTU would stage 9 more work actions. Some lasted only 2 days. The longest was 19 days long. In 2002, the Chicago Teachers Union again went out on strike, recalling their historic fighting spirit. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So real quick, I want to hit on Pearson watching on DirecTV. I'll ask the question. Evidently, I had said not too long ago that Obama was all in favor of apprenticeship programs and people, you know, not having to go to college to be able to get, you know, building trades jobs and all that. And he did this years ago. Understand, this isn't some Johnny come lately. The Biden push towards apprenticeship programs, not something, you know, that's just happened. This is something Biden's believed all along. But during the Obama years, if you remember, one of the things that the Dems got pushed through was the Workforce Opportunity and Investment Act, or WEOA, or Investment and Opportunity Act. And what that was to do is across the country and states set up apprenticeship programs across all industries, not just the building trades. It would have given states the ability to take some of this WEOA money and begin their training of people in needed industries. And not going to college, they were to pair up with community colleges to get certificates or even unions to start ones. I know the Teamsters started a dock workers apprenticeship program where they trained people to be dock workers. You know, the CDL, a lot of CDL stuff came out of that. So this idea that you don't need to go to college to get a decent job. And look, I'm not opposed to people going to college. It's an investment that. You know, if you get a good degree,
you're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.